He did not know who had scouted Helmuth's base, or put the thionite into it. He had no idea who it was who had killed Helmuth. As far as he knew, nothing had ever been done about any Bosconian spies and patrol bases. He had never happened to hear of the planet Medon, or of anyone named Bominger, or Madame de Pleiades, or Prelin. He was entirely ignorant of any unusual weapons of offense. He was a psychologist, not an engineer or a physicist. No, he was not unusually adept with delimiters. "Hold on," Eichmiel commanded. "Stop questioning him, everybody. Now, Lensman, instead of telling us what you do not know, give us positive information in your own way. How do you work? I am beginning to suspect that the man we really want is a director, not an operator." That was a more productive line. Lensmen, hundreds of them, each worked upon definite assignment. None of them had ever seen or ever would see the man who issued orders. He had not even a name, but was a symbol, star A star. They received orders through their lenses, wherever they might be in space. They reported back to him in the same way. Yes, star A star knew what was going on there. He was reporting constantly. A knife descended viciously. Blood spurted. The stump was dressed, roughly but efficiently. They did not wish their victim to bleed to death when he died, and he was not to die in any fashion, yet. And in the instant that Kinnison's lens went dead, Warsel, from his safely distant nook, reached out direct to the mind of his friend, thereby putting his own life in jeopardy. He knew that there was an overlord in that room, and the grue of a thousand helplessly sacrificed generations of forebears swept his sinuous length at the thought, despite his inward certainty of the new powers of his mind. He knew that of all the entities in the universe, the Dalgonians were most sensitive to the thought vibrations of Volantians. Nevertheless, he did it. He narrowed the beam down to the smallest possible coverage, employed a frequency as far as possible from that ordinarily used by the overlords, and continued to observe. It was risky, but it was necessary. It was beginning to appear as though the Earthman might not be able to escape, and he must not die in vain. "Can you communicate now?" In the ghastly chamber, the relentless questioning went on. "I cannot communicate." "It is well. In one way, I would not be averse to letting your star A star know what happens when one of his minions dares to spy upon the Council of Boscone itself. But the information is as yet a trifle premature. Later, he shall learn." Kinnison did not consciously thrill at that thought. He did not know that the news was going beyond his brain, that he had achieved his goal. Warsel, however, did, and Warsel thrilled for him. The Grey Lensman had finished his job. All that was left to do was to destroy that base, and the power of Boscone would be broken. Kinnison could die now, content. But no thought of leaving entered Warsel's mind. He would, of course, stand by as long as there remained the slightest shred of hope, or until some development threatened his ability to leave the planet with its priceless information. And the pitiless Inquisition went on. Star A Star had sent him to investigate their planet, to discover whether or not there was any connection between it and the Zwillnik organization. He had come alone, in a speedster. No, he could not tell them even approximately where the speedster was. It was so dark, and he had come such a long distance on foot. In a short time, though, it would start sending out a thought signal which he could detect.
"But you must have some ideas about this Star A Star."
This director was the man they want so desperately to get. They believed implicitly in this figment of a Lensman director. Fitting in so perfectly with their own ideas of efficient organization, it was more convincing by far than the actual truth would have been. They knew now that he would be hard to find. They did not now insist upon facts. They wanted every possible crumb of surmise.
"You must have wondered who and where Star A Star is. You must have tried to trace him."
Yes, he had tried, but the problem could not be solved. The lens was non-directional, and the signals came in at practically the same strength anywhere in the galaxy. They were, however, very much fainter out here. That might be taken to indicate that Star A Star's office was in a star cluster, well out in either zenith or nadir direction. The victim sucked dry, eight of the council departed, leaving Eichmill and the Overlord with the lensman.
What you have in mind to do, Eichmill, is childish. Your basic idea is excellent, but your technique is pitifully inadequate.
What could be worse? Eichmill demanded. I am going to dig out his eyes, smash his bones, flay him alive, roast him, cut him up into a dozen pieces, and send him back to his Star A Star with a warning that every creature he sends into this galaxy will be treated the same way. What would you do?
You of the Ike lack finesse, the Dalgonian sighed. You have no subtlety, no conception of the nicer possibilities of torture, either of an individual or of a race. For instance, to punish Star A Star adequately, this man must be returned to him alive, not dead.
Impossible. He dies here.
You misunderstand me. Not alive as he is now, but not entirely dead. Bones broken, yes, and eyes removed, fine, but those minor matters are but a beginning. If I were doing it, I should then apply several of these devices here successively, but none of them to the point of complete incompatibility with life. I should inoculate the extremities of his four limbs with an organism which grows, shall we say, unpleasantly. Finally, I should extract his life force and consume it. As you know, that material is a rarely satisfying delicacy with us, taking care to leave just enough to maintain a bare existence. I should then put what is left of him aboard his ship, start it toward the Tellurian galaxy, and send notice to the patrol as to his exact course and velocity.
But they would find him alive, Eichmill stormed.
Exactly. For the fullest vengeance, they must, as I have said. Which is worse, think you? To find a corpse, however dismembered, and to dispose of it with full military honors, or to find and to have to take care of for a full lifetime as something that has not enough intelligence even to swallow food placed in its mouth. Remember, also, that the organism will be such that they themselves will be obliged to amputate all four of the creature's limbs to save his life.
While thinking thus, the Dalgonian shot out a slender tentacle which, slithering across the floor, flipped over the tiny switch of a small mechanism in the center of the room. This entirely unexpected action almost stunned Worsel. He had been debating for moments whether or not to release the Grey Lensman's inhibitions. He would have done so instantly if he had had any warning of what the Dalgonian was about to do. Now it was too late.
I have set up a thought screen about the room. I do not wish to share this tidbit with any of my fellows, as there is not enough to divide, the monster explained parenthetically. Have you any suggestion as to how my plan may be improved?
No. You have shown that you understand torture better than we do.
I should, since we overlords have practiced it as a fine art since our beginnings as a race. Do you wish the pleasure of breaking his bones now?
I do not break bones for pleasure. Since you do, you may carry out the procedure as outlined. All I want is the assurance that he will be an object lesson and a warning to Star A Star of the patrol.
I can assure you definitely that it will be both. More, I will show you the results when I finish my work. Or, if you like, I would be glad to have you stay and look on. You will find the spectacle interesting, entertaining, and highly instructive.
No. No thanks.
Eichmill left the room, and the Dalgonian turned his attention to the bound and helpless lensman. It is best, perhaps, to draw a kindly veil over the events of the next 2 hours. Kinnison himself refuses positively to discuss it, except to say, I knew how to set up a nerve block then, so I can't say that any of it really hurt me. I wouldn't let myself feel it. But all the time I knew what he was doing to me, and it made me sick. Did you ever watch a surgeon while he was taking out your appendix? Like that, only worse. It wasn't funny. I didn't like it a bit. Your readers wouldn't like it either, so you'd better lay off that stuff entirely. The The mere fact that the Overlord had established coverage was, of course, sufficient to set up in the Lensman's mind a compulsion to knock it down. He had to break that screen. But there were no birds here, no spiders. Was there any life at all? There was. That torture room had been used fully and often. The muck in its drains was rich pasture for the Jarnivonian equivalent of worms. Selecting a big one, long and thick, Kinnison tuned down to its mental level and probed. This took time, much, much too much time. The creature did not nearly have the intelligence of a spider, but it did have a dim consciousness of being and therefore an ego of a sort. Also, when Kinnison finally got in touch with that ego, it reacted very favorably to his suggestion of food. "Hurry, worm, snap it up!" And the little thing really did hurry. Scrambling, squirming, almost leaping along the floor, it hurried, in a very grotesquerie of haste. The Delgonian's leisurely preliminary work was done. The feast was ready. The worm reached the generator while the Overlord was warming up the tubes of the apparatus which was to rive away that which made the man, Kinnison, everything that he was. Curling one end of its sinuous shape around a convenient anchorage, Kinnison's small proxy reached up and looped the other about the handle of the switch. Then, visions of choice viands suffusing its barely existent consciousness, it contracted convulsively. There was a snap, and the mental barrier went out of existence. At the tiny sound, the Delgonian whirled and stopped. Worsel's gigantic mentality had been beating ceaselessly against that screen ever since its erection, and in the instant of its fall, Kinnison again became the Grey Lensman of old. And in the next instant, both those prodigious minds, the two most powerful then known to civilization, had hurled themselves against that of the Delgonian. Bitter though the ensuing struggle was, it was brief. Nothing short of an Aresian mind could have withstood the venomous fury, the berserk power of that concerted and synchronized attack. Brain half burned out, the Overlord wilted, and docility itself, he energized the communicator.
"Eichmiel, the work is done, thoroughly done and well. Do you wish to inspect it before I put what is left of the Lensman into his ship?"
"No."
Eichmiel, as a high executive, was accustomed to delegating far more important matters than that to competent underlings.
"If you are satisfied, I am."
Weirdly enough to any casual observer, the Overlord's first act was to deposit the worm, carefully and tenderly, in a spot in which the muck was particularly rich and toothsome. Then, picking up the hideously mangled thing that was Kinnison's body, he encased it in his armor, and, donning his own, wriggled boldly away with his burden.
"Clear the way for me, please," he requested of Eichmiel. "I go to place this residuum within its ship, and to return it to Star A Star."
"You will be able to find the speedster?"
"Certainly, he was to find it. Whatever he could have done, I, working through the cells of his brain, can likewise do." "Can you handle him alone, Kinnison?"
Worsel asked presently.
"Can you hold out to the speedster?"
"Yes, to both. I can handle him. We whittled him down to a nub. I'll last. I'll make myself last long enough."
"I go then, lest they be observing with spy rays."
To the black flyer, then, the completely subservient Delgonian carried his physically disabled master, and carefully he put him aboard. Worsel helped openly there, for he had screened the speedster against all forms of intrusion. The vessel took off, and the Overlord wriggled blithely back toward the dome. He was full of the consciousness of a job well done. He even felt the sensation of repletion concomitant with having consumed practically all of Kinnison's life force.
"I hate to let him go,"
Worsel's thought was a growl of baffled hatred.
"It gripes me to let him think that he did everything he set out to do, even though I know it had to be that way. I still want to tear him apart for what he has done to you, my friend."
"Thanks, old snake," Kinnison's thought came faintly. "Just Temporary. He's living on borrowed time. He'll get his. You've got everything under control, haven't you?
On the green. Why?
Because I can't hold this nerve block any longer. It hurts. I'm sick. I think I'm going to...
He fainted. More. He plunged parsecs deep into the blackest depths of oblivion as outraged nature took the toll she had so long been denied. Worsel hurled a call to Earth, then turned to his maimed and horribly broken companion. He applied splints to the shattered limbs. He dressed and bandaged the hideous wounds and the raw sockets which had once held eyes. He ministered to the raging, burning thirst. Whenever Kinnison's mind wearied, he held for him the nerve block, the priceless anodyne without which the gray lensman must have died from sheerest agony.
Why not allow me, friend, to relieve you of all consciousness until help arrives?
The Volantian asked, pityingly.
Can you do it without killing me?
If you so allow, yes. If you offer any resistance, I do not believe that any mind in the universe could.
I won't resist. Come in.
And Kinnison's suffering ended. But kindly Worsel could do nothing about the fantastically atrocious growth which were transforming the Earthman's legs and arms into monstrosities out of nightmare. He could only wait. Wait for the skilled assistance which he knew must be so long in coming.
Chapter 21. Amputation. When Worsel's hard-driven call impinged upon the Port Admiral's lens, he dropped everything to take the report himself. Characteristically, Worsel sent first and Haines, first recorded, a complete statement of the successful mission to Jarnovan. Last came personalities, the tale of Kinnison's ordeal, and his present plight.
Are they following you in force, or can't you tell?
Nothing detectable, and at the time of our departure there had been no suggestion of any such action,
Worsel replied, carefully.
We'll come in force anyway, and fast. Keep him alive until we meet you, Haines urged, and disconnected.
It was an unheard-of occurrence for the Port Admiral to turn over his very busy and extremely important desk to a subordinate without notice, and without giving him instructions, but Haines did it now.
Take charge of everything, Southworth, he snapped. I'm called away. Emergency. Kinnison found Boscone, got away, hurt. I'm going after him in the Dauntless, taking the new flotilla with me. Indefinite time, probably a few weeks.
He strode toward the communicator desk. The Dauntless was, as always, completely serviced and ready for any emergency. Where was that fleet of her sister ships? On its shakedown cruise? He'd shake them down. They had with them the new hospital ship, too, the only Red Cross ship in space that could leg it parsec for parsec with the Dauntless.
Get me navigations. Figure best point of rendezvous for Dauntless and Flotilla ZKD, both at full blast, en route to Lundmark's Nebula. 15 minutes departure. Figure approximate time of meeting with Speedster, also at full blast, leaving that nebula hour 9:14 today. Correction. Cancel Speedster meeting. We can compute that more accurately later. Advise Adjutant. Admiral Southworth will send order through channels. Get me base hospital. Lacey, please. Kinnison's hurt. Sawbones. Bad. I'm going out after him. Coming along?
Yes, how about...
On the green. Flotilla ZKD, including your new 200 million credit hospital, is going along. Slip 12. Dauntless, 11.5 minutes from now. Hype!
And the Surgeon Marshal hyped. 2 minutes before the scheduled takeoff, base navigations called the chief navigating officer of the Dauntless.
Course to rendezvous with Flotilla ZKD, latitude 354-30, longitude 19-42, time approximately 12-7-26, place 1-3-0, outside arbitrary galactic rim, check and repeat,
rattled from the speaker without pause or punctuation. Nevertheless, the chief navigator got it, recorded it, checked it, and repeated it.
Figures only approximations because of lack of exact data on variations in density of medium and on distance necessarily lost in detouring stars, the speaker chattered on. Suggest instructing your second navigator to communicate with navigating officers Flotilla ZKD at time 12-0 to correct courses to compensate unavoidably erroneous assumptions in computation-based navigations. Off.
I'll say he's off. Way off,
growled the second. What does he think I am, a complete nitwit? Pretty soon he'll be telling me that 2+2=4.0. The 15-second warning bell sounded. Every man came to the ready at his post, and precisely upon the designated second, the super dreadnought blasted off. For 4 or 5 miles, she rose inert upon her underjets, sirens and flaring lights clearing her way. Then she went free, her needle prow slanted sharply upward, her full battery of main driving projectors burst into action, and to all intents and purposes, she vanished. The Earth fell away from her at an incredible rate, dwindling away into invisibility in less than a minute. In 2 minutes, the sun itself was merely a bright star. In 5, it had merged indistinguishably into the sharply defined, brilliantly white belt of the Milky Way. Hour after hour, day after day, the Dauntless hurtled through space, swinging almost imperceptibly this way and that to avoid the dense ether in the neighborhood of suns through which the designated course would have fled, but never leaving far or for long the direct line, almost exactly in the equatorial plane of the galaxy, between Tellus and the place of meeting. Behind her, the Milky Way clotted, condensed, gathered itself together. Before her and around her, the stars began rapidly to thin out. Finally, there were no more stars in front of her. She had reached the arbitrary rim of the galaxy, and the second navigator then on duty plugged into communications. "Please get me Flotilla ZKD flagship navigations," he requested, and as a clean-cut young face appeared upon his plate. "Hi, Harvey, old space hound. Fancy meeting you out here. It's a small universe, isn't it? Say, did that crumb back there at base tell you two to be sure and start checking course before you overran the rendezvous? If he was singling me out to make a pass at, I'm going to take steps, and not through channels, either."
"Yeah, he told me the same. I thought it was funny, too. An Oiler's pimp would know enough to do that without being told. We figured maybe he was jittery on account of us meeting the Admiral or something. What's burned out all the jets, Paul, to get the big brass hats way out here and all dithered up, and to pull us off at the cruise that way? Must be a hell of an important flit. You're competing the old man himself. You must know something. What's this speedster that we're going to escort, and why? Give us the dope."
"I don't know anything, Harvey, honest, any more than you do. They didn't put out a thing." "Well, we'd better be getting onto the course to compensate unavoidably erroneous assumptions in computation," he mimicked caustically. "What do you read on my lambda? 14.3.06 decrement." The conversation became a technical jargon, because of which, however, the courses of the flying spaceships changed subtly. The flotilla swung around, through a small arc of a circle of prodigious radius, decreasing by a tenth its driving force. Up to it the Dauntless crept, through it and into the van. Then again, in cone formation, but with 55 units instead of 54, the flotilla screamed forward at maximum blast. Well before the calculated time of meeting the speedster, a Volantian lensman who knew Wurzel well put himself on rapport with him and sent a thought out far ahead of the flying squadron. It found its goal. Lensmen of that race, as has been brought out, have always been extraordinarily capable communicators. And once more the course was altered slightly. In due time, Wurzel reported that he could detect the fleet, and shortly thereafter,
"Wurzel says to cut your drive to zero,"
the Volantian transmitted.
"He's coming up. We're close. He's going to go inert and start driving. We're to stay free until we see what his intrinsic velocity is. Watch for his flare."
It was a weird sensation, this, of knowing that a speedster, quite a sizable chunk of boat, really, was almost in their midst, and yet having all their instruments, even the electros, register empty space. There it was. The flare of the driving blast, a brilliant streamer of fierce white light, sprang into being and drifted rapidly away to one side of their course. When it had attained a safe distance,
"All ships of the flotilla, except the Dauntless, go inert," Haines directed.
Then to his own pilot,
Back us up a bit, Henderson, and do the same.
And the new flagship, too, went inert.
How can I get on to the Pasteur the quickest, Haines?
Lacey demanded.
Take a gig, the Admiral grunted, and tell the boys how much you want to take. 3 G's is all we can use without warning and preparation.
There followed a curious and fascinating spectacle, for the hospital ship had an intrinsic velocity entirely different from that of either Kinnison's speedster or Lacey's powerful gig. The Pasteur, gravity pads cut to zero, was breaking down by means of her underjets at a conservative 1.4 gravities. Hospital ships were not allowed to use the brutal accelerations employed as a matter of course by ships of war. The gig was on her brakes at 5 gravities, all that Lacey wanted to take. But the speedster! Worsell had put his patient into a pressure pack and had hung him on suspension, and was balancing her down on her tail at a full 11 gravities. But even at that, the gig first matched the velocity of the hospital ship. The intrinsics of those two were at least of the same order of magnitude, since both had come from the same galaxy. Therefore, Lacey boarded the Red Cross vessel and was escorted to the office of the chief nurse, while Worsell was still blasting at 11 G's, 50,000 miles distant then and getting farther away by the second, to kill the speedster's Lundmarkian intrinsic velocity. Nor could the tractors of the warships be of any assistance. The speedster's own vicious jets were fully capable of supplying more acceleration than even a pressure-packed human body could endure.
How do you do, Dr. Lacey? Everything is ready?
Clarissa MacDougall met him, hand outstretched. Her saucy white cap was worn as perkily cocked as ever, perhaps even more so now that it was emblazoned with the cross-surmounted wedge, which is the insignia of Sector Chief Nurse. Her flaming hair was as gorgeous, and her smile as radiant, her bearing as confidently, Kinnison had said of her on more than one occasion, that she is the only person he has ever known who can strut sitting down, as calmly poised.
I'm very glad to see you, Doctor. It's been quite a while.
Her voice died away, for the man was looking at her with an expression defying analysis, for Lacey was thunderstruck. If he had ever known it, and he must have, he had completely forgotten that MacDougall had this ship. This was awful. Terrible.
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. How do you do? Mighty glad to see you again. How's everything going?
He pumped her hand vigorously, thinking frantically the while what he could say next.
By the way, who is to be in charge of the operating room?
Why, I am, of course, she replied in surprise. Who else would be?
Anyone else, he wanted to say, but did not. Not then.
Why, that isn't at all necessary. I would suggest...
You'll suggest nothing of the kind,
she stared at him intently. Then, as she realized what his expression really meant, she had never before seen such a look of pitying anguish upon his usually sternly professional face. Her own turned white, and both hands flew to her throat.
Not Kim, Lacey, she gasped.
Gone now was everything of poise, of insouciance, which had so characterized her a moment before. She, who had worked unflinchingly upon all sorts of dismembered, fragmentary, maimed and mangled men, was now a pleading, stricken, desperately frightened girl.
Not Kim, please. Oh, merciful God, don't let it be my Kim. You can't be there, Mac.
He did not need to tell her. She knew. He knew that she knew.
Somebody else. Anybody else.
No, came the hot negative, although the blood drained completely from her face, leaving it as white as the immaculate uniform she wore. Her eyes were black, burning holes.
It's my job, Lacey, in more ways than one. Do you think I'd let anyone else work on him?
She finished passionately.
You'll have to, he declared. I didn't want to tell you this, but it's a mess.
This, from a surgeon of Lacey's long and wide experience, was an unthinkable statement. Nevertheless,
all the more reason why I've got to do it. No matter what shape he's in, I'll let no one else work on my Kim.
I say no. That's an order. Official. Damn such orders, she flamed. There's nothing back of it. You know that as well as I do. See here, young woman. Do you think you can order me not to perform the very duties I swore to do? She stormed. And even if it were not my job, I'd come in and work on him if I had to get a torch and cut my way in to do it. The only way you can keep me out is to have about 10 of your men put me into a straitjacket, and if you do that, I'll have you kicked out of the service bodily.
QX MacDougall, you win.
She had him there.
This girl could and would do exactly that.
But if you faint, I'll make you wish. You know me better than that, Doctor.
She was cold now as a woman of marble.
If he dies, I'll die too, right then. But if he lives, I'll stand by.
You would at that, the surgeon admitted. Probably you would be able to hold together better than anyone else could. But there will be after effects, in your case, you know.
I know. Her voice was bleak. I'll live through them, if Kim lives.
She became all nurse in the course of a breath. White, cold, inhuman. Strung to the highest tension and yet placidly calm, as only a truly loving woman in life's great crises can be.
You have had reports on him, Doctor. What is your provisional diagnosis?
Something like elephantiasis, only worse, affecting both arms and both legs. Drastic amputations indicated. Eye sockets, burns. Multiple and compound fractures. Punctured and incised wounds. Traumatism. Ecchymosis. Extensive extravasations. Edema. Profound systemic shock. The prognosis, however, seems to be favorable as far as we can tell.
I'm glad of that, she breathed, the woman for a moment showing through the armor of the nurse.
She had not dared even to think of prognosis. Then she had a thought.
Is that really true, or are you just giving a shot in the arm? She demanded.
The truth, strictly, he assured her. Warsaw has an excellent sense of perception, and has reported fully and clearly. His brain, mind, and spine are not affected in any way, and we should be able to save his life. That is the one good feature of the whole thing.
The speedster finally matched the intrinsic velocity of the hospital ship. She went free, flashed up to the Pasteur, inerted, and maneuvered briefly. The larger vessel engulfed the smaller. The gray lensman was carried into the operating room. The anesthetist approached the table, and Lacey was stunned at a thought from Kinnison.
Never mind the anesthetic, Dr. Lacey. You can't make me unconscious without killing me. Just go ahead with your work. I held a nerve block while the Dalgonian was doing his stuff, and I can hold it while you're doing yours.
But we can't, man! Lacey exclaimed. You've got to be under a general for this job. We can't have you conscious. You're raving, I think. It will work. It always has. Let us try it anyway, won't you?
Sure. It'll save me the trouble of holding the block, even though it won't do anything else. Go ahead.
The attendant doctor did so, with the same cool skill and to the same end point as in thousands of similar and successful undertakings. At its conclusion,
"Gone now, aren't you, Kinson?" Lacey asked through the lens.
"No," came the surprising reply.
"Physically, it worked. I can't feel a thing, and I can't move a muscle, but mentally, I'm still here."
"But you shouldn't be," Lacey protested.
"Perhaps you were right at that. We can't give you much more without danger of collapse. But you've got to be unconscious. Isn't there some way in which you could be made so?"
"Yes, there is, but why do I have to be unconscious?" he asked curiously.
"To avoid mental shock. Seriously damaging," the surgeon explained. "In your case, particularly the mental aspect is graver than the purely physical one."
"Maybe you're right, but you can't do it with drugs. Call Warsaw. He's done it before. He had me unconscious most of the way over here, except when he had to give me a drink or something to eat. He's the only man this side of Aresia who can operate on my mind."
And so Warsaw came.
"Sleep, my friend," he commanded, gently but firmly. "Sleep profoundly, body and mind, with no physical or mental sensations, no consciousness, no perception even of the passage of time. Sleep so until someone having authority to do so bids you awaken."
And Kinnison slept, so deeply that even Lacey's probing lens could elicit no response.
"He will stay that way?" Lacey asked in awe.
"Yes.
For how long?"
"Indefinitely. Until one of your doctors or nurses tells him to wake up, or until he dies for lack of food or water."
"He'll get nourishment. It would make a much better recovery if we could keep him in that state until his injuries are almost healed. Would that hurt him?"
"Not at all."
Then the surgeons and the nurses went to work.
Since it has already been made amply plain what had to be done to the Grey Lensman, no good end is to be served by following in revolting detail the stark hideousness of its actual doing. Suffice it to say, then, that Lacey was not guilty of exaggeration when he described Kinnison as being a mess. He was. The job was long and hard. It was heartbreaking, even for those to whom Kinnison was merely another case, not a beloved personality. What they had to do, they did. And the white marble chief nurse carried on through every soul-wrenching second, through every shocking, searing motion of it. She did her part stoically, unflinchingly, as efficiently as if the patient upon the table were a total stranger undergoing a simple appendectomy and not the one man in her entire universe undergoing radical dismemberment. Nor did she faint, then. 3 or 4 of the girls fainted dead away, and a couple of the interns turned sort of green around the gills, she explained to your historian in reply to a direct question. She can bring herself to discuss the thing now that it is so happily past, although she does not like to do so. But I held on until it was all over. I did more than faint then. She smiled wryly at the memory. I went into such a succession of hysterical cat fits that they had to give me hypos and keep me in bed, and they didn't let me see Kim again until we had him back at base hospital on Tellus. But even old Lacey himself was so woozy that he had to have a couple of snifters of brandy, so the show I put on wasn't too much out of order at that. Back in base hospital, then, time wore on until Lacey decided that the Lensman could be aroused from his trance. Clarissa woke him up. She had fought for the privilege, first claiming it as a right, and then threatening to commit mayhem upon the person of anyone else who dared even to think of doing it. "Wake up, Kim, dear," she whispered. "The worst of it is over now. You are getting well." The Grey Lensman came to instantly, in full command of every faculty, knowing everything that had happened up to the instant of his hypnosis by Wurzel. He stiffened, ready to establish again the nerve block against the intolerable agony to which he had been subjected so long, but there was no need. His body was, for the first time in untold eons, free from pain, and he relaxed blissfully, reveling in the sheer comfort of it. "I'm so glad that you're awake, Kim," the nurse went on. "I know that you can't talk to me. We can't unbandage your jaw until next week. And you can't think at me either, because your new lens hasn't come yet. But I can talk to you, and you can listen. Don't be discouraged, Kim. Don't let it get you down. I love you just as much as I ever did. And as soon as you can talk, we're going to get married. I am going to take care of you." "Don't poor dear me, Mac," he interrupted her with a vigorous thought. "You didn't say it, I know, but you were thinking it. I'm not half as helpless as you think I am. I can still communicate, and I can see as well as I ever could, or better. And if you think I'm going to let you marry me to take care of me, you're crazy."
"You're raving, delirious, stark raving mad!"
She started back, but then controlled herself with an effort.
"Maybe you can think at people without a lens. Of course you can, since you just did it at me. But you can't see Kim, possibly. Believe me, boy, I know you can't. I was there."
"I can, though," he insisted. "I got a lot of stuff on my second trip to Aresia that I couldn't let anybody know about then, but I can now. I've got as good a sense of perception as Tregoncey has, maybe better. To prove it, you look thin, worn, whittled down to a nub. You've been working too hard. On me."
"Deduction," she scoffed. "You'd know I would."
"QX. How about those roses over there on the table? White ones, yellow ones, and red ones with ferns."
"You can smell them, perhaps," dubiously. Then, with more assurance, "you would know that practically all the flowers known to botany would be here."
"Well, I'll count them and point them out to you, then. Or better, how about that little gold locket with CM engraved on it that you're wearing under your uniform? I can't smell that, nor the picture in it." The man's thought faltered in embarrassment.
"Hey, my picture! Clono's whiskers, Mac. Where did you get that, and why?"
"It's a reduction that Admiral Haynes let me have made. I'm wearing it because I love you. I've said that before." The girl's entrancing smile was now in full evidence. She knew now that he could see, that he would never be the helpless hulk which she had so gallingly thought him doomed to become. And her spirits rose in ecstatic relief. But he would never take the initiative now. QX, then, she would. And this was as good an opening as she would ever have with the stubborn brute. Therefore, more than that, as I also said before, I am going to marry you, whether you like it or not. She blushed a heavenly and discordant magenta, but went on unfalteringly. And not out of pity either, Kim, or just to take care of you. It's older than that, much older.
It can't be done, Mac.
His thought was a protest to high heaven at the injustice of fate. I've thought it over in space 1,000 times. Thought until I was black in the face. But I get the same result every time. It's just simply no soap. You are much too fine a woman, too splendid, too vital. Too much of everything a woman should be. To be tied down for life to a thing that's half steel, rubber, and phenylene. It just simply isn't on the wheel, that's all. You're full of pickles, Kim. Gone was all her uncertainty and nervousness. She was calm, poised, glowing with a transcendent inward beauty. I didn't really know until this minute that you loved me too, but I do now. Don't you realize, you big, dumb, wonderful clunker, that as long as there's one single little bit of a piece of you left alive, I'll love that piece more than I ever could any other man's entire being? But I can't, I tell you, he groaned the thought. I can't and I won't. My job isn't done yet either, and next time they'll probably get me. I can't let you waste yourself, Mac, on a fraction of a man for a fraction of a lifetime. QX, Grey Lensman. Clarissa was serene, radiantly untroubled. She could make things come out right now. Everything was on the green. We'll put this back up on the shelf for a while. I'm afraid that I've been terribly remiss in my duties as a nurse. Patients mustn't be excited or quarreled with, you know. That's another thing. How come you, a sector chief, to be doing ordinary room duty and night duty at that?
Sector chiefs assign duties, don't they? She retorted sunnily.
Now, I'll give you a rub and change some of those dressings.
Chapter 22. Regeneration.
Hi, Skeleton Gazer.
Oh, Big Chief feet on the desk.
I see your red-headed sector chief is still occupying all strategic salience in force.
Haynes had paused in the Surgeon Marshal's office on his way to another of his conferences with the Grey Lensman.
Can't you get rid of her, or you don't want to?
Don't want to? Couldn't, anyway, probably. The young vixen would tear down the hospital. She might even resign, marry him out of hand, and lug him off somewhere. You want him to recover, don't you?
Don't be any more of an idiot than you have to. What a question.
Don't work up a temperature about McDougal, then. As long as she's around him, and that's 24 hours a day, he'll get everything in the universe that he can get any good out of.
That's so, too. This other thing's out of our hands now, anyway. Kinnison can't hold his position long against her and himself both. Overwhelmingly superior force. Just as well, too. Civilization needs more like these two.
Check. But the affair isn't out of our hands by any means. We've got quite a little fine work to do there yet, as you'll see before it'll be a really good job. But about Kinnison?
Yes. When are you going to fit arms and legs on him? He should be practicing with them at this stage of the game, I should think. I was.
You should think, but unfortunately you don't, was the surgeon's dry rejoinder. If you did, you would have paid more attention to what Phillips has been doing. He's making the final test today. Come along and we'll explain it to you again. Your conference with Kinnison can wait 30 minutes.
In the research laboratory which had been assigned to Phillips, they found von Hohendorf with the Posenian. Haynes was surprised to see the old commandant of cadets, but Lacey quite evidently had known that he was to be there.
Phillips, the surgeon marshal began, explain to this warhorse in words of as few syllables as possible what you are doing.
The original problem was to discover what hormone or other agent caused proliferation of neural tissue.
Wait a minute, I'd better do it, Lacey broke in. Besides, you wouldn't do yourself justice.
The first thing he found out was that the problem of repairing damaged nervous tissue was inextricably involved with several other unknown things, such as the original growth of such tissue and its relationship to growth in general, the regeneration of lost members in lower forms, and so on. You see, Haynes, it's a known fact that nerves do grow, or else they could not exist, and in lower forms of life they regenerate. Those facts were all he had at first. In higher forms, even during the growth stage, regeneration does not occur spontaneously. Phillips set out to find out why. The thyroid controls growth, but does not initiate it, he learned. This fact seemed to indicate that there was an unknown hormone involved, that certain lower types possess an endocrine gland which is either atrophied or non-existent in higher types. If the latter, it was no landing. He reasoned, however, since higher types evolved from lower, that the gland in question might very well exist in a vestigial state. He studied animals, thousands of them, from the germ upward. He exhausted the patience of the Porcidian authorities, and when they cut off his appropriation, on the ground that the thing was impossible, he came here. We felt that if he was so convinced of the importance of the work as to be willing to spend his whole life on it, the least we could do would be to support him. We gave him carte blanche. The man is a miracle of perseverance, a keen observer, a shrewd reasoner, and a mechanic par excellence, a born researcher. So he finally found out what it must be, the pineal. Then he had to find the stimulant, drugs, chemicals, the spectrum of radiation, singly and in combination. Years of plugging, with just enough progress to keep him at it. Visits to other planets peopled by races human to two places or more, learning everything that had been done along that line. When you fellows moved Medon over here, he visited it as routine. And there he hit the jackpot. Wise himself is a surgeon, and the Medonians have had warfare and grief enough to develop the medical and surgical arts no end. They knew how to stimulate the pineal, but their method was dangerous. With Philip's fresh viewpoint, his wide knowledge and his mechanical genius, they worked out a new and highly satisfactory technique. He was going to try it out on a pirate slated for the lethal chamber, but von Hohendorf heard about it and insisted on being the guinea pig. Got up on his unattached lensman's high horse and won't come down, so here we are. Interesting. The Admiral had listened attentively. You're pretty sure it'll work then, I gather. As sure as we can be of any technique so new. 90% probability, say perhaps 95. Good enough odds. Haynes turned to von Hohendorf. What do you mean, you old reprobate, by sneaking around behind my back and horning in on my reservation? I raid unattached too, you know, and it's mine. You're out, von. I saw it first, and I refuse to relinquish. Von Hohendorf was adamant. You've got to, Haynes insisted. He isn't your cub anymore, he's my lensman. Besides, I'm a better test than you are. I've got more parts to replace than you have. 4 or 5 make just as good a test as a dozen, the commandant declared.
Gentlemen, think, the Pulsinian pleaded. Please consider that the pineal is actually inside the brain. It is true that I have not been able to discover any brain injury so far, but the process has not yet been applied to a Tellurian brain, and I can offer no assurance whatever that some obscure injury will not result.
What of it? And the two old unattached lensmen resumed their battle, hammer and tongs. Neither would yield a millimeter. Operate on them both, then, since they're both above law or reason, Lacey finally ordered in exasperation. There ought to be a law to reduce gray lensmen to the ranks when they begin to suffer from ossification of the intellect. Starting with yourself, perhaps? The Admiral shot back, not at all abashed. Haynes relented enough to let von Hohendorf go first, and both were given the necessary injections. The Commandant was then strapped solidly into a chair. His head was immobilized with clamps. The Pulsinian swung his needle rays into place. Two of them, each held rigidly upon micrometered racks and each operated by two huge, double, rock-steady hands. The operator looked entirely aloof. Being eyeless and practically headless, it is impossible to tell from a Pulsinian's attitude or posture anything about the focal point of his attention.
but the watchers knew that he was observing in microscopic detail the tiny gland within the old lensman's skull. Then Haines.
"Is this all there is to it, or do we come back for more?" he asked, when he was released from his shackles.
"That's all," Lacey answered. "One stimulation lasts for life, as far as we know. But if the treatment was successful, you'll come back about a day after tomorrow, I would think, to go to bed here. Your spare equipment won't fit, and your stumps may require surgical attention." Sure enough, Haines did come back to the hospital, but not to go to bed. He was too busy. Instead, he got a wheelchair, and in it, he was taken back to his now boiling office. And in a few more days, he called Lacey in high exasperation.
"Know what you've done?" he demanded. "Not satisfied with taking my perfectly good parts away from me, you took my teeth, too. They don't fit. I can't eat a thing, and I'm hungry as a wolf. I don't think I was ever so hungry in all my life. I can't live on soup, man. I've got work to do. What are you going to do about it?"
"Ho, ho, 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 ho," Lacey roared. "Served you right. Von Hohendorf is taking it easy here, sitting on top of the world. Easy now, sailor, don't rupture your aorta. I'll send a nurse over with a soft-boiled egg and a spoon. Ha! Teething at your age! Ha, 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 ha!"
But it was no ordinary nurse who came a few minutes later to see the port admiral. It was the sector chief herself. She looked at him pityingly as she trundled him into his private office and shut the door, thereby establishing complete coverage.
"I had no idea, Admiral Haines, that you... that there..." She paused.
"That I was so much of a rebuild?" he asked complacently. "Except in the matter of eyes, which he doesn't need anyway, our mutual friend Kinnison has very little on me, my dear. I got so handy with the replacements that very few people knew how much of me was artificial. But it's these teeth that are taking all the joy out of life. I'm hungry, confound it. Have you got anything really satisfying that I can eat?"
"I'll say I have."
She fed him, then, bending over, she squeezed him tight and kissed him emphatically. "You and the Commandant are just perfectly wonderful old things." "And I love you," she declared. "Lacey was simply poisonous to laugh at you the way he did. Why, you're two of the world's very best. And he knew perfectly well all the time, the lug, that of course you'd be hungry, that you'd have to eat twice as much as usual while your legs and things were growing. Don't worry, Admiral. I'll feed you until you bulge. I want you to hurry up with this so they'll do it to Kim."
"Thanks, Mac."
And as she wheeled him back into the main office, he considered her anew. A ravishing creature, but sound. Rash, and a bit stubborn, perhaps. Impetuous, and headstrong. But clean, solid metal all the way through. She had what it takes. She qualified. She and Kinnison would make a mighty fine couple when the lad got some of that heroic damn nonsense knocked out of his head. But there was work to do. There was. The Galactic Council had considered thoroughly Kinnison's reports. Its every member had conferred with him and with Worsell at length. Throughout the first galaxy, the patrol was at work in all its prodigious might, preparing to wipe out the menace to civilization which was Boscone. First-line super-dreadnoughts, no others would go upon that mission, were being built and armed, rebuilt and rearmed. Well it was that the Galactic Patrol had previously amassed an almost inexhaustible supply of wealth, for its reserves of expendable credit were running like water. Weapons, supposedly already of irresistible power, were made even more powerful. Screens, already impenetrable, were stiffened into even greater stubbornness. Primary projectors were made to take even higher loads for longer times. New and heavier Q-type helices were designed and built. Larger and more destructive duodec bombs were hurled against already ruined, torn, and quivering test planets. Uninhabited worlds were being equipped with super Bergenholms and with driving projectors. The Negasphere, the most incredible menace to navigation which had ever existed in space, was being patrolled by a cordon of guard ships. And all this activity centered in one vast building, and culminated in one man, Port Admiral Haines, Galactic Counselor. And Haines could not even get enough to eat because he was cutting a new set of teeth.
He cut them. All 32 of them. Arm and leg, foot and hand grew perfectly, even to the nails. Hair grew upon what for years had been a shining expanse of pate. But much to Lacey's relief, it was old skin, not young, that covered the new limbs. It was white hair, not brown, that was dulling the glossiness of Haines' bald old head. His trifocals, unchanged, were still necessary if he were to see anything clearly, near or far.
"Our experimental animals aged and died normally," he explained graciously. "But I was beginning to wonder if we had rejuvenated you two, or perhaps endowed you with eternal life. Glad to see that the new parts have the same physical age as the rest of you. It would be mildly embarrassing to have to kill two Grey Lensmen to get rid of them."
"You're about as funny as a rubber crutch," Haines grunted. "When are you going to give Kinnison the works? Don't you realize we need him?"
"Pretty quick now. Just as soon as we give you and Vaughn your psychological examinations."
"Bah, that isn't necessary. My brain's QX."
"That's what you think. But what do you know about brains? Wurzel will tell us what shape your mind, if any, is in."
The Volantian put both Haines and von Hohendorf through a grueling examination, finding that their minds had not been affected in any way by the stimulants applied to their pineal glands. Then, and only then, did Phillips operate upon Kinnison, and in his case, too, the operation was a complete success. Arms and legs and eyes replaced themselves flawlessly. The scars of his terrible wounds disappeared, leaving no sign of ever having been. He was a little slower, however, somewhat clumsy and woefully weak. Therefore, instead of discharging him from the hospital as cured, which procedure would have restored him automatically all the rights and privileges of an unattached lensman, the council decided to transfer him to a physical culture camp. A few weeks there would restore him entirely the strength, speed, and agility which had formerly been his, and he would then be allowed to resume active duty. Just before he left the hospital, Kinnison strolled with Clarissa out to a bench in the grounds.
"And you're making a perfect recovery," the girl was saying. "You'll be exactly as you were. But things between us aren't just as they were, and they never can be again. You know that, Kim. We've got unfinished business to transact. Let's take it down off the shelf before you go."
"Better let it lay, Mac."
All the newfound joy of existence went out of the man's eyes. "I'm whole, yes, but that angle was really the least important of all. You never have yet faced squarely the fact that my job isn't done, and that my chance of living through it is just about 1 in 10. Even Phillips can't do anything about a corpse."
"I won't face it either, unless and until I must."
Her reply was tranquility itself. "Most of the troubles people worry about in advance never do materialize. And even if it did, you ought to know that that any woman would rather... well, that half a loaf is better than no bread."
"Huh. QX. I haven't mentioned the worst thing, though. I didn't want to. But if you've got to have it, here it is," the man wrenched out. "Look at what I am. A barroom brawler, a rum-dum, a hard-boiled egg, a cold-blooded, ruthless murderer, even of my own men."
"Not that, Kim, ever, and you know it," she rebuked him.
"What else can you call it?" he grated.
"A killer besides. A red-handed butcher if there ever was one. Then, now and forever, I've got to be. I can't get away from it. Do you think that you or any other decent woman could stand it to live with me? That you could feel my arms around you, feel my gory paws touching you without going sick at the stomach?" "Oh, so that's what's really been griping you all this time?"
Clarissa was surprised, but entirely unshaken.
"I don't have to think about that, Kim. I know. If you were a murderer or had the killer instinct, that would be different. But you aren't, and you haven't. You are hard, of course. You have to be. But do you think I'd be running a temperature over a softy? You brawl, yes, like the world champion you are. Anybody you ever killed needed killing, there's no question of that. You don't do these things for fun. And the fact that you can drive yourself to do the things that have to be done shows your real size. Nor have you even thought of the obverse, that you lean over backwards and wielding that terrific power of yours. The De Pleyanese woman, the Countess,
lots of other instances. I respect and honor you more than any other man I've ever known. Any woman who really knew you would. She must. Listen, Kim, read my mind, all of it. You'll really know me then, and understand me better than I can ever explain myself.
Have you got a picture of me doing that? He asked, flatly.
No, you big, unreasonable clunker, I haven't, she flared, and that's just what's driving me mad. Then, voice dropping to a whisper, almost sobbing, Cancel that, Kim, I didn't mean it. You wouldn't, you couldn't, I suppose, and I'd still be you, the man I love. But isn't there something, anything that will make you understand what I really am?
I know what you are. Kinnison's voice was uninflected, weary. As I have told you before, the universe's best. It's what I am that's clogging the jets. What I've been and what I've got to keep on being. I simply don't rate up, and you'd better lay off me, Mac, while you can. There's a poem by one of the ancients, Kipling, The Ballad of Beau Dathone, that describes it exactly. You wouldn't know it.
You just think I wouldn't, she said, nodding brightly. The only trouble is, you always think of the wrong verses. Part of it really is descriptive of you. You know, where all the soldiers of the Black Tyrone thought so much of their captain? She recited. And worshipped with fluency, fervor, and zeal, the mud on the boot heels of Crook O'Neill. That describes you to a T.
You're crazy for the lack of sense, he demurred. I don't rate like that.
Sure you do, she assured him. All the men think of you that way. And not only men, women too, darn 'em. And the next time I catch one of them at it, I'm going to kick her cursed teeth out, one by one.
Kinnison laughed, albeit a trifle sourly. You're raving, Mac. Imagining things. But to get back to that poem, what I was referring to went like this.
I know how it goes. Listen. But the captain had quitted the long-drawn strife, and Infar Samuri had taken a wife. And she was a damsel of delicate mold, with hair like the sunshine and heart of gold. And little she knew the arms that embrace had cloven a man from the brow to the waist. And little she knew that the loving lips had ordered a quivering life's eclipse, and the eyes that lit at her blightest breath had glared unawed in the gates of death. For these be matters a man would hide, as a general thing, from an innocent bride.
That's what you mean, isn't it? She asked quietly. Mac, you know a lot of things you've got no business knowing.
Instead of answering her question, he stared at her speculatively.
My sprees and brawls, Dessa de Pleiades and the Countess Avondrin, and now this. Would you mind telling me how you get the stuff?
I'm closer to you than you suspect, Kim. I've always been. Warsaw calls it being en rapport. You don't need to think of me. In fact, you have to put up a conscious block to keep me out. So I know a lot that I shouldn't, but lensmen aren't the only ones who don't talk. You'd been thinking about that poem a lot. It worried you, so I checked with archaeology on it, and I memorized most of it.
Well, to get the true picture of me, you'll have to multiply that by 1,000. Also, don't forget that loose heads might be rolling out onto your breakfast table almost any morning instead of only once.
So what? She countered evenly. Do you think I could sit for Kipling's portrait of Mrs. O'Neill? Nobody ever called my mold delicate, and Kipling, if he had been describing me, would have said, with hair like a conflagration and a heart of solid brass.
Captain O'Neill's bride, as well as being innocent and ignorant, strikes me as having been a good deal of a sissy, something of a weeping willow, and no little of a shrinking violet. Tell me, Kim, do you think she would have made a good as a sector chief nurse?
No, but that's neither.
It is, too, she interrupted. You've got to consider that I did, and that it's no job for any girl with a weak stomach. Besides, the beau's head took the fabled Mrs. O'Neill by surprise. She didn't know that her husband used to be in the wholesale mayhem and killing business.
I do.
And lastly, you big lug, do you think I'd be making such bare-faced passes at you unless I knew exactly what the score is, exactly where you stand? You're too much of a gentleman to read my mind, but I'm not that squi... I had to know. Huh? He demanded, blushing fiercely. You really know, then, that...
He would not say it, even then.
Of course I know.
She nodded. Then, as the man spread his hands helplessly, she abandoned her attempt to keep the conversation upon a light level. I know, my dear. There's nothing we can do about it yet. Her voice was unsteady, her heart in every word.
You have to do your job,
and I honor you for that, even if it does take you away from me. It'll be easier for you, though, I think, and I know it will be easier for me, to have it out in the open. Whenever you're ready, Kim, I'll be here, or somewhere, waiting. Clear ether, Gray Lensman. And rising to her feet, she turned back toward the hospital. Clear ether, Chris. Unconsciously, he used the pet name by which he had thought of her for so long. He stared after her for a minute, hungrily. Then, squaring his shoulders, he strode away. And upon Far Jarnavon, Eichmiel, the first of Boscone, was conferring with Jalti via communicator. Long since the Colonian had delivered through devious channels the message of Boscone to an imaginary director of Lensman. Long since had he received this cryptically direful reply, Morgan lives, and so does Star a Star. Jalti had not been able to report to his chief any news concerning the fate of that which the speedster bore, since spies no longer existed within the reservations of the patrol. He had learned of no discovery that any Lensman had made. He could not venture a hypothesis as to how this Star a Star had heard of Jarnavon, or had learned of its location. He was sure of only one thing, and that was a grimly disturbing fact indeed. The patrol was rearming throughout the galaxy, upon a scale theretofore unknown. Eichmiel's thought was cold.
That means but one thing. A Lensman invaded you, and learned of us here. In no other way could knowledge of Jarnavon have come to them.
Why me? Jalti demanded. If there exists a mind of power sufficient to break my screens and tracelessly to invade my mind, what of yours?
It is proven by the outcome.
The Bosconian statement was a calm summation of fact.
The messenger sent against you succeeded. The one against us failed. The patrol intends and is preparing, certainly to wipe out our remaining forces within the Tellurian galaxy, probably to attack your stronghold, eventually to invade our own galaxy.
Let them come, snarled the Colonian. We can and will hold this planet forever against anything they can bring through space.
I would not be too sure of that, cautioned the Superior. In fact, if, as I am beginning to regard as a probability, the patrol does make a concerted drive against any significant number of our planetary organizations, you should abandon your base there and return to Colonia, after disbanding and so preserving for future use as many as possible of the planetary units.
Future use? In that case there will be no future.
There will so, Eichmiel replied, coldly vicious. We are strengthening the defenses of Jarnavon to withstand any conceivable assault. If they do not attack us here of their own free will, we shall compel them to do so. Then, after destroying their every mobile force, we shall again take over their galaxy. Arms for the purpose are even now in the building. Is the matter clear?
It is clear. We shall warn all our groups that such an order may issue, and we shall prepare to abandon this base should such a step become desirable.
So it was planned. Neither Eichmiel nor Jalti even suspecting two startling truths. First, that when the patrol was ready it would strike hard and without warning, and second, that it would strike not low, but high. Chapter 23 Annihilation. Kinnison played, worked, rested, ate, and slept. He boxed, strenuously and viciously, with masters of the craft. He practiced with his delameters until he'd regained his old-time speed and dead-center accuracy.
He swam for hours at a time. He ran in cross-country races. He lolled practically naked in hot sunshine. And finally, when his muscles were writhing and rippling as of yore beneath the bronze satin of his skin, Lacey answered his insistent demands by coming to see him. The gray lensman met the flyer eagerly, but his face fell when he saw that the Surgeon Marshal was alone. "No, MacDougall didn't come. She isn't around anymore," Lacey explained guilefully. "Huh?" came startled query. "How come?" "Out in space, out Barova way somewhere. What do you care? After the way you've acted, you've got the crust of a rhinoceros to..." "You're crazy, Lacey. Why, we..." "She said..." "It's all fixed up." "Funny kind of fixing. Moping around base, crying her red head off. Finally, though, she decided she had some Scotch pride left, and I let her go aboard again. If she isn't all done with you, she ought to be." This, Lacey figured, would be good for what ailed the big sap head. "Come on, and I'll see whether you're fit to go back to work or not." He was fit. "QX, lad, flit," Lacey discharged him informally with a slap upon the back. "Get dressed, and I'll take you back to Haynes. He's been snapping at me like a turtle ever since you've been out here." At Prime Base, Kinnison was welcomed enthusiastically by the Admiral. "Feel those fingers, Kim," he exclaimed. "Perfect, just like the originals." "Mine, too. They do feel pretty good." "It's a pity you got your new one so quick. You'd appreciate him much more after a few years without him. But, to get down to business, the fleets have been taking off for weeks. We're to join up as the line passes. If you haven't anything better to do, I'd like to have you aboard the Z9M9Z.
"I don't know of any place I'd rather be, sir. Thanks."
"QX. Thanks should be the other way. You can make yourself mighty useful between now and zero time." He eyed the younger man speculatively. Haynes had a special job for him, Kinnison knew. As a gray lensman, he could not be given any military rank or post, and he could not conceive of the Admiral of Grand Fleet wanting him around as an aide-de-camp. "Spill it, Chief," he invited. "Not orders, of course. I understand that perfectly. Requests. Or, suggestions?" "I will crown you with something yet, you whelp," Haynes snorted, and Kinnison grinned. These two were very close, in spite of their disparity in years, and very much of a piece. "As you get older, you'll realize that it's good tactics to stick pretty close to General Regs." "Yes, I have got a job for you, and a nasty one. Nobody has been able to handle it, not even two companies of Virgilians. Grand Fleet Operations."
"Grand Fleet Operations?" Kinnison was aghast. "Holy clonos, iridium intestines! What makes you think I've gotten up to swing that load?"
"I haven't any idea whether you can or not. If you can't, though, nobody can. And in spite of all the work we've done on the thing, we'll have to operate as a mob, the way we did before, not as a fleet. If so, I shudder to think of the results."
"QX, if you'll send for Warsaw, we'll try it for a fling or two. It'd be a shame to build the whole ship around an operations tank and then not be able to use it. By the way, I haven't seen my head nurse, Miss MacDougall, you know, around any place lately, have you? I ought to tell her thanks for something, maybe send her a flower."
"Nurse? MacDougall? Oh yeah, the redhead. Let me see, did you hear something?
I did hear something about her the other day.
Married? No, took a hospital ship somewhere.
Alsakan? Vandemar? Didn't pay any attention. She doesn't need thanks or flowers either, getting paid for her work. Much more important, don't you think, to get operations straightened out?"
"Undoubtedly, sir," Kinnison replied stiffly, and as he went out, Lacey came in. The two old conspirators greeted each other with knowing grins. Was Kinnison ever taking it big? He was falling like 10,000 bricks down a well.
"Do him good to undermine his position a bit. Too cocky altogether. But how they do suffer."
"Check."
The gray lensman rode toward the flagship in a mood which even he could not have described. He had expected to see her as a matter of course. He wanted to see her. Confound it, he had to see her. Why did she have to do a flit now, of all the times on the calendar? She knew the fleet was shoving off and that he'd have to go along, and nobody knew where she was. When he got back, he'd find her, and if he had to chase her all over the galaxy, he'd put an end to this. Duty was duty, of course, but Chris was Chris, and half a loaf was better than no bread. He jerked back to reality as he entered the gigantic teardrop, which was technically the Z9M9Z. Socially, the Directrix, and ordinarily, GFHQ. She had been designed and built specifically to be Grand Fleet Headquarters, and nothing else. She bore no offensive armament, but since she had to protect the presiding geniuses of combat, she had every possible defense. Port Admiral Haynes had learned a bitter lesson during the expedition to Helmuth Space. Long before that relatively small fleet got there, he was sick to the core, realizing that 50,000 vessels simply could not be controlled or maneuvered as a group. If that base had been capable of an offensive, or even of a real defense, or if Boscone could have put their fleets into that star cluster in time, the patrol would have been defeated ignominiously, and Haynes, wise old tactician that he was, knew it. Therefore, immediately after the return from that triumphant venture, he gave orders to design and to build, at whatever cost, a flagship capable of directing efficiently 1 million combat units. The tank, the minutely cubed model of the galaxy which is a necessary part of every pilot room, had grown and grown as it became evident that it must be the prime agency in Grand Fleet operations. Finally, in this last rebuilding, the tank was 700 feet in diameter and 80 feet thick in the middle, over 17 million cubic feet of space in which more than 2 million tiny lights crawled hither and thither in helpless confusion. For after the technicians and designers had put that tank into actual service, they had discovered that it was useless. No available mind had been able either to perceive the situation as a whole, or to identify with certainty any light or group of lights needing correction, not to mention linking up any particular light with its individual blanket-proof communicator in time to issue orders in space combat. Kinnison looked at the tank, then around the full circle of the 1 million plug board encircling it. He observed the horde of operators, each one trying frantically to do something. Next, he shut his eyes, the better to perceive everything at once, and studied the problem for an hour. "Attention, everybody," he thought then. "Open all circuits. Do nothing at all for a while." He then called Haynes. "I think we can clean this up if you'll send over some simplex analyzers and a crew of technicians. Helmuth had a nice setup on multiplex controls, and Jalti had some ideas, too. If we add them to this, we may have something." And by the time Worsel arrived, they did. "Red lights are fleets already in motion," Kinnison explained rapidly to the Volantian. "Greens are fleets still at their bases. Ambers are the planets the reds took off from, connected, you see, by Ryerson string lights. The white star is us, the Directrix. That violet cross way over there is Jalti's planet, our first objective. The pink comets are our free planets, their tails showing their intrinsic velocities. Being so slow, they had to start long ago. The purple circle is the negasphere. It's on its way, too. You take that side, I'll take this. They were supposed to start from the edge of the 12th sector. The idea was to make it a smooth, bowl-shaped sweep across the galaxy converging upon the objective. But each of the system marshals apparently wants to run this war to suit himself. Look at that guy there. He's beating the gun by 9,000 parsecs. Watch me pin his ears back." He pointed his simplex at the red light, which had so offendingly sprung into being. There was a whirring click, and the number 449276 flashed above a board. An operator flicked a switch. "Grand Fleet Operations," Kinnison's thought snapped across space. "Why are you taking off without orders?"
"Why, I'll give you the marshal, sir."
"No time. Tell your marshal that one more such break will put him in irons. Land at once. GFO off." "With around 1 million fleets to handle, we can't spend much time on any one," he thought at Worsel. "But after we get them lined up and get our Regellians broken in, it won't be so bad." The breaking in did not take long. Definite and meaningful orders flew faster and faster along the tiny but steel-hard beams of the communicators. Takeoff, increase drive 4.5, decrease drive 2.8, change course 2, and so it went, hour after hour and day after day. And with the passage of time came order out of chaos. The red lights formed a gigantically sweeping, curving wall, its almost imperceptible forward crawl representing an actual velocity of almost 100 parsecs an hour. Behind that wall blazed a sea of amber, threaded throughout the brilliant filaments which were the Ryerson lights. Ahead of it lay a sparkling, almost solid blaze of green. Closer and closer the wall crept toward the bright white star. And in the reducer, the standard 10-foot tank in the lower well, the entire spectacle was reproduced in miniature. It was plainer there, clearer and much more readily seen, but it was so crowded that details were indistinguishable. Haines stood beside Kinnison's padded chair one day, staring up into the immense lens and shaking his head. He went down the flight of stairs to the reducer, studied that, and again shook his head. "This is very pretty, but it doesn't mean a thing," he thought at Kinnison. "It begins to look as though I'm going along just for the ride. You, or you and Warsel, will have to do the fighting too, I'm afraid." "Uh-uh," Kinnison demurred. "What do we or anyone else know about tactics compared to you? You've got to be the brains. That's why we had the boys rig up the original working model there for a reducer. On that, you can watch the gross developments and tell us in general terms what to do. Knowing that, we'll know who ought to do what from the big chart here and pass your orders along." "Say, that will work at that," and Haines brightened visibly. "Looks as though a couple of those reds are going to knock our star out of the tank, doesn't it?" "It'll be close in that reducer. They'll probably touch. Close enough in real space, less than 3 parsecs. The 0 hour came, and the Tellurian armada of 81 sleek spaceships, 80 super dreadnoughts and the Directrix, spurned Earth and took its place in that hurtling wall of crimson. Solar system after solar system was passed. Fleet after fleet leaped into the ether and fitted itself into the smoothly geometric pattern which Grand Fleet Operations was nursing along so carefully. Through the galaxy the formation swept, and out of it, and toward a star cluster. It slowed its mad pace, the center hanging back, the edges advancing and folding in. "Surround the cluster and close in," the Admiral directed, and under the guidance now of 200 Regellians, civilization's vast Grand Fleet closed smoothly in and went inert. Drivers flared white as they fought to match the intrinsic velocity of the cluster. "Marshals of all system fleets, attention! Using secondaries only, fire at will upon any enemy object coming within range. Engage outlying structures and such battlecraft as may appear. Keep assigned distance from planet and stiffen cosmic screens to maximum. Haines, off!" From millions upon millions of projectors, there raved out gigantic rods, knives, and needles of force, under the impact of which the defensive screens of Jalti's guardian citadels flamed into terrible refulgence. Duodec bombs were hurled, tight beam-directed monsters of destruction which, looping around in vast circles to attain the highest possible measure of momentum, flung themselves against Boscone's defenses in Herculean attempts to smash them down. They exploded, each as it burst filling all nearby space with blindingly intense violet light and with flying scraps of metal. Q-type helices, driven with all the frightful kilowattage possible to Midonian conductors and insulation, screwed in, biting, gouging, tearing in with wild abandon. Shear planes, hellish knives of force beside which Tellurian lightning is pale and wan, struck and struck and struck again, fiendishly, crunchingly. But those grimly stolid fortresses could take it. They had been repowered, their defenses stiffened to such might as to defy, in the opinion of Boscone's experts, any projectors capable of being mounted upon mobile bases. And not only could they take it, those formidably armed and armored planetoids could dish it out as well. The screens of the patrol ships flared high into the spectrum under the crushing force of sheer enemy power. Not a few of those defenses were battered down, clear to the wall shields, before the unimaginable ferocity of the Bosconian projectors could be neutralized. And at this spectacularly frightful deep space engagement, Galactic Director Jalti, and through him Eichmiel, first of Boscone itself, stared in stunned surprise. "It is insane," Jalti gloated.
The fools judged our strength by that of Helmuth, not considering that we, as well as they, would be both learning and doing during the intervening time. They have a myriad of ships, but mere numbers will never conquer my outposts, to say nothing of my works here.
They are not fools. I am not so sure, Eichmiel cogitated.
He would have been even less sure could he have listened to a conversation which was even then being held.
QX, Thorndyke? Kimson asked.
On the green, came instant reply. Intrinsic, placement, releases, everything on the green. Cut.
And the lone purple circle disappeared from tank and from reducer. The master technician had cut his controls, and every pound of metal and other substance surrounding the negasphere had fallen into that enigmatic realm of nothingness. No connection or contact with it was now possible. And with its carefully established intrinsic velocity, it rushed engulfingly toward the doomed planet. One of the mastodonic fortresses lying in its path vanished utterly, with nothing save a burst of invisible cosmics to mark its passing. It approached its goal. It was almost upon it, before any of the defenders perceived it, and even then they could neither understand nor grasp it. All detectors and other warning devices remained static, but...
Look! There! Something's coming!
An observer jittered, and Jalti swung his plate. He saw... nothing. Eichmiel saw the same thing. There was nothing to see. A vast, intangible nothing, yet a nothing tangible enough to occult everything material in a full third of the cone of vision. Jalti's operators hurled into it their mightiest beams. Nothing happened. They struck nothing and disappeared. They loosed their heaviest duodec torpedoes, gigantic missiles whose warheads contained enough of that frightfully violent detonate to disrupt a world. Nothing happened. Not even an explosion. Not even the faintest flash of light. Shell and contents alike merely, and oh, so incredibly peacefully, ceased to exist. There were important bursts of cosmics, but they were invisible and inaudible, and neither Jalti nor any member of his force was to live long enough to realize how terribly he had been already burned. Gigantic pressers shoved against it, beams of power sufficient to deflect a satellite, beams whose projectors were braced in steel-laced concrete down to bedrock against any conceivable thrust. But this was negative, not positive matter. Matter negative in every respect of mass, inertia, and force. To it, a push was a pull. Pressers to it were tractors. At contact, they pulled themselves up off their massive foundations and hurtled into the appalling blackness. Then, the negasphere struck. Or did it? Can nothing strike anything? It would be better, perhaps, to say that the spherical hyperplane, which was the three-dimensional cross-section of the negasphere, began to occupy the same volume of space as that in which Jalti's unfortunate world already was. And at the surface of contact of the two, the materials of both disappeared. The substance of the planet vanished. The incomprehensible nothingness of the negasphere faded away into the ordinary vacuity of empty space. Jalti's base, the whole 300 square miles of it, was taken at the first gulp. A vast pit opened where it had been. A hole which deepened and widened with horrifying rapidity. And as the yawning abyss enlarged itself, the stuff of the planet fell into it, in turn to vanish. Mountains tumbled into it, oceans dumped themselves into it. The hot, frightfully compressed and nascent material of the planet's core sought to erupt, but instead of moving, it too vanished. Vast areas of the world's surface crust, tens of thousands of square miles in extent, collapsed into it, splitting off among crevices of appalling depth, and became nothing. The stricken globe shuddered, trembled, ground itself to bits in paroxysm after ghastly paroxysm of disintegration. What was happening? Eichmiel did not know, since his eye was destroyed before any really significant developments could eventuate. He and his scientists could only speculate and deduce, which, with surprising accuracy, they did. The officers of the patrol ships, however, knew what was going on, and they were scanning with tensely narrowed eyes the instruments which were recording instant by instant the performance of the new cosmic superscreens which were being assaulted so brutally. For, as has been said, the negasphere was composed of negative matter. Instead of electrons, its building blocks were positrons, the direct holes in an infinity of negative energy. Whenever the field of a positron encountered that of an electron, the two neutralized each other, giving rise to two quanta of hard radiation. And, since those encounters were occurring at the rate of countless trillions per second, there was tearing at the patrol's defenses a flood of cosmics of an intensity which no spaceship had ever before been called upon to withstand, but the new screens had been figured with a factor of safety to 5, and they stood up. The planet dwindled with soul-shaking rapidity to a moon, to a moonlet, and finally to a discreetly conglomerate aggregation of meteorites, before the mutual neutralization ceased. "Primaries now," Haynes ordered briskly, as the needles of the cosmic ray screen's meters dropped back to the green lines of normal functioning. The probability was that the defenses of the Vasconian citadels would now be automatic only, that no life had endured through that awful flood of lethal radiation, but he was taking no chances. Out flashed the penetrant super-rays, and the fortresses, too, ceased to exist, save as the impalpable infra-dust of space. And the massed grand fleet of the Galactic Patrol, remaking its formation, hurled outward through the intergalactic void. Chapter 24. Passing of the Ike.
"They are not fools, I am not so sure," Eichmill had said, and when the last force ball, his last means of intergalactic communication, went dead, the first of Boscone became very unsure indeed. The patrol undoubtedly had something new. He himself had had glimpses of it. But what was it? That Jalti's base was gone was obvious. That Boscone's hold upon the Tellurian galaxy was gone followed as a corollary. That the patrol was, or soon would be, wiping out Boscone's regional and planetary units was a logical inference. Star A. Star, that accursed director of Lensman, had, must have, succeeded in stealing Jalti's records to be willing to destroy out of hand the base which housed them. Nor could Boscone do anything to help the underlings, now that the long-awaited attack upon Jarnivon itself was almost certainly coming. Let the patrol come. They were ready. Or were they? Quite. Jalti's defenses were strong, but they had not withstood that unknown weapon even for seconds. Eichmill called a joint meeting of Boscone and the Academy of Science. Coldly and precisely, he told them everything that he had seen. Discussion followed.
"Negative matter beyond a doubt," a scientist summed up. "It has long been surmised that in some other, perhaps hyperspatial universe, there must exist negative matter of mass sufficient to balance the positive material of the universe we know. It is conceivable that by hyperspatial explorations and manipulations the Tellurians have discovered that other universe and have transported some of its substance into ours."
"Can they manufacture it?" Eichmill demanded.
"The probability that such material can be manufactured is exceedingly small," was the studied reply. "An entirely new mathematics would be necessary. In all probability, they found it already existent."
"We must also find it, then, and at once."
"We will try. Bear in mind, however, that the field is large, and do not be optimistic of an early success. Note also that the substance is not necessary, perhaps not even desirable in a defensive action."
"Why not?"
"Because, by directing pressers against such a bomb, Jalti actually pulled it into his base,
precisely where the enemy wished it to go. As a surprise attack against those ignorant of its true nature, such a weapon would be effective indeed. But against us, it will prove a boomerang. All that is needful is to mount tractor heads upon pressor bases, and thus drive the bombs back upon those who send them. It did not occur, even to the coldest scientist of them all, that that bomb had been of planetary mass. Not one of the Ike suspected that all that remained of the entire world upon which Jalti's base had stood was a handful of meteorites.
"Let them come, then," said Eichmiel, grimly. "Their dependence upon a new and supposedly unknown weapon explains what would otherwise be insane tactics. With that weapon impotent, they cannot possibly win a long war waged so far from their bases. We can match them, ship for ship. And more. And our supplies and munitions are close at hand. We will wear them down, blast them out. The Tellurian galaxy shall yet be ours."
Admiral Haynes spent almost every waking hour setting up and knocking down tactical problems in the practice tank, and gradually his expression changed from one of strained anxiety to one of pleased satisfaction. He went over to his sealed band transmitter, called all communications officers to attention, and thought, "Each vessel will direct its longest-range detector at highest possible power, centrally, upon the objective galaxy. The first observer to find detectable activity, however faint, will report it instantly to GHQ. We will find and send out a general CB, at which every vessel in Grand Fleet will cease blasting at once, remaining motionless in space until further orders."
He then called Kinnison.
"Look here," he directed the attention of the younger man and into the reducer, which now represented intergalactic space, with a portion of the second galaxy filling one edge.
"I have a solution, but its practicability depends upon whether or not it calls for the impossible from you, Wurzel, and your Rigellians. You remarked at the start that I knew my tactics. I wish I knew more, or at least could be certain that Boscone and I agree on what constitutes good tactics. I feel quite safe in assuming, however, that we shall meet their Grand Fleet well outside the galaxy."
"Why?" asked the startled Kinnison. "If I were Eichmiel, I'd pull every ship I had in and around Jarnivon and keep it there. They can't force engagement with us."
"Poor tactics. The very presence of their fleet out in space will force engagement, and a decisive one at that. From his viewpoint, if he defeats us there, that ends it. If he loses, that's only his first line of defense. His observers will have reported fully. He will have invaluable data to work upon and much time before even his outlying fortresses can be threatened. From our viewpoint, we can't refuse battle if his fleet is there. It would be suicidal for us to enter that galaxy, leaving intact outside it a fleet as powerful as that one is bound to be."
"Why? Harrying us from the rear might be bothersome, but I don't see how it could be disastrous."
"Not that. They could, and would, attack Tellus."
"Oh. I never thought of that. But couldn't they, anyway, two fleets?"
"No. He knows that Tellus is very strongly held, and that this is no ordinary fleet. He will have to concentrate everything he has upon either one or the other. It is almost inconceivable that he could divide his forces."
"QX, I said that you're the brains of the outfit. You are."
"Thanks, lad. At the first sign of detection, we stop. They may be able to detect us, but I doubt it, since we're looking for them as special instruments. But that's immaterial. What I want to know is, can you and your crew split Grand Fleet, making two big hollow hemispheres of it? Let this group of ambers represent the enemy. Since they know we'll have to carry the battle to them, they'll probably be in fairly close formation. Set your two hemispheres, the reds, there and there. Close them in, thus englobing their whole fleet. Can you do it?"
Kinnison whistled through his teeth, a long, low, unmelodious whistle.
"Yes. But clone those carbaloy claws, Chief. Suppose they catch you at it."
"How can they? If you were using detectors instead of double-end tight-beam binders, how many of our own vessels could you locate?"
That's right, too. About 2% of them. They couldn't tell that they were being englobed until long after it was done. They could, however, globe up inside us.
Yes, and that would give them the tactical advantage of position, the Admiral admitted.
We probably have, however, enough superiority in firepower, if not in actual tonnage, to make up the difference. Also, we have speed enough, I think, so that we can retire in good order. But you're assuming that they can maneuver as rapidly and as surely as we can, a condition which I do not consider at all probable. If, as I believe much more likely, they have no better Grand Fleet operations than we had in Helmuth's Star Cluster, if they haven't the equivalent of you and Warsel and this supertank here, then what?
In that case, it'd be just too bad, just like pushing baby chicks into a pond.
Kinnison saw the possibilities very clearly after they had been explained to him.
How long will it take you?
With Warsel and me and both full crews of Regellians, I guess it would take about 10 hours. 8 to compute and assign positions, and 2 to get there.
Fast enough. Faster than I would have thought possible. Oil up your simplexes and calculating machines and get ready.
In due time, the enemy fleet was detected, and the cease blasting signal was given. Civilization's prodigious fleet stopped dead, hanging motionless in space at the tantalizing limit of detectability from the warships awaiting them. For 8 hours, 200 Regellians stood at the whirring calculators, each solving course and distance problems at the rate of 10 per minute. 2 hours or less of free flight, and Haines rejoiced audibly in the perfection of the 2 red hemispheres shown in his reducers. The 2 huge bowls flashed together, rim to rim. The sphere began inexorably to contract. Each ship put out a red K6T screen as a combined battle flag and identification, and the greatest naval engagement of the age was on. It soon became evident that the Bosconians could not maneuver their forces efficiently. The fleet was too huge, too unwieldy for their operations officers to handle. Against an equally uncontrollable mob of battlecraft, it would have made a showing, but against the carefully planned chronometer-timed attack of the patrol, individual action, however courageous or however desperate, was useless. Each red-sheathed destroyer hurtled along a definite course at a definite force of drive for a definite length of time. Orders were strict. No ship was to be lured from course, pace, or time. They could, however, fight en passant with their every weapon if occasion arose, and occasion did arise some thousands of times. The units of Grand Fleet flashed inward, lashing out with their terrible primaries at everything in space not wearing the crimson robe of civilization. And whatever those beams struck did not need striking again. The warships of Boscone fought back. Many of the patrol's defensive screens blazed hot enough to almost to mask the scarlet beacons. Some of them went down. A few patrol ships were englobed by the concerted action of 2 or 3 subfleet commanders more cooperative or more farsighted than the rest, and were blasted out of existence by an overwhelming concentration of power. But even those vessels took toll with their primaries as they went out. Few indeed were the Bosconians who escaped through holes thus made. At a predetermined instant, each dreadnought stopped, to find herself one unit of an immense, red-flaming, hollow sphere of ships packed almost screen to screen. And upon signal, every primary projector that could be brought to bear hurled bolt after bolt as fast as the burned-out shells could be replaced into the ragingly incandescent inferno which that sphere's interior instantly became. For 200 million discharges such as those will convert a very large volume of space into something utterly impossible to describe. The raving torrents of energy subsided, and keen-eyed observers swept to the scene of action. Nothing was there, except jumbled and tumbling white-hot wreckage. A few vessels had escaped during the closing in of the sphere, but none inside it had survived this climactic action. Not one in 5,000 of Boscone's massed fleet made its way back to Jarnovan.
Maneuver 58, hype!
Haines ordered, and again Grand Fleet shot away. There was no waiting, no hesitation. Every course and time had been calculated and assigned. Into the second galaxy, the scarcely diminished armada of the patrol hurtled.
to Jarnivon's solar system. Around it. Once again, the crimson sheathing of civilization's messengers almost disappeared in blinding coruscants as the outlying fortresses unleashed their mighty weapons. Once again, a few ships, subjected to such concentrations of force as to overload their equipment, were lost. But this conflict, though savage in its intensity, was brief. Nothing mobile could withstand for long the utterly hellish energies of the primaries, and soon the armored planetoids, too, ceased to be. "Maneuver 59, hype!" And Grand Fleet closed in upon dark Jarnivon.
60!
It rolled in space, forming an immense cylinder, the doomed planet the midpoint of its axis.
61!
Tractors and pressers leaped out from ship to ship and from ship to shore. The patrolmen did not know whether or not the scientists of the Ike could render their planet inertialess, and now it made no difference. Planet and fleet were, for the time being, one rigid system.
62, blast!
And against the world-girdling battlements of Jarnivon, there flamed out in all their appalling might the dreadful beams against which the defensive screens of battleships and of mobile citadels alike had been so pitifully inadequate. But these which they were attacking now were not the limited installations of a mobile structure. The Ike had at their command all the resources of a galaxy. Their generators and conductors could be of any desired number and size. Hence, Eichmiel, in view of prior happenings, had strengthened Jarnivon's defenses to a point which certain of his fellows derided as being beyond the bounds of sanity or reason. Now those unthinkably powerful screens were being tested to the utmost. Bolt after bolt of quasi-solid lightning struck against them, spitting mile-long sparks in baffled fury as they raged to ground. Plain and encased in Q-type helices they came, biting, tearing, gouging. Often and oftener, under the threat of half a dozen at once, local failures appeared. But these were only momentary, and even the newly devised shells of the patrol's projectors could not stand the load long enough to penetrate effectively Boscone's indescribably capable defenses. Nor were Jarnivon's offensive weapons less capable. Rods, cones, planes, and shears of pure force bored, cut, stabbed, and slashed. Bombs and dirigible torpedoes charged to the skin with duodec sought out the red-cloaked ships. Beams, sheathed against atmosphere in Q-type helices, crashed against and through their armoring screens. Beams of an intensity almost to rival that of the patrol's primary weapons and of 100 times their effective aperture. And not singly did those beams come. 8, 10, 12 at once they clung to and demolished dreadnought after dreadnought of the expeditionary force. Eichmiel was well content.
"We can hold them, and we are burning them down," he gloated. "Let them lose their negative matter bombs. Since they are burning out projectors, they cannot keep this up indefinitely. We will blast them out of space."
He was wrong. Grand Fleet did not stay there long enough to suffer serious losses. For even while the cylinder was forming, Kinnison was in rapid but careful consultation with Thorndike, checking intrinsic velocities, directions, and speeds.
"QX burn, cut!" he yelled. 2 planets, one well within each end of the combat cylinder, went inert at the word,
resuming instantaneously their diametrically opposed intrinsic velocities of some 30 miles per second. And it was these 2 very ordinary but utterly irresistible planets, instead of the negative matter bombs with which the Ike were prepared to cope, which hurtled then along the axis of the immense tube of warships toward Jarnivon. Whether or not the Ike could make their planet inertialess has never been found out. Free or inert, the end would have been the same.
"Every Y-14M officer of every ship of the patrol, attention," Haynes ordered. "Don't get all tensed up. Take it easy. There's lots of time. Any time within a second after I give the word will be plenty of time. Cut!"
The 2 worlds rushed together, doomed Jarnivon squarely between them. Haynes snapped out his order as the three were well within 2 seconds of contact. And as he spoke, all the pressers and all the tractors were released. The ships of the patrol were already free. None had been inert since leaving Jalti's ex-planet, and thus could not be harmed by flying debris. The planets touched. They coalesced, squishingly at first, the encircling warships drifting lightly away before a cosmically violent blast of superheated atmosphere. Jarnivan burst open all the way round and spattered. Billions upon billions of tons of hot core magma being hurled afar in gouts and streamers. The two planets, crashing through what had been a world, met, crunched, crushed together in all the unimaginable momentum of their masses and velocities. They subsided, crashingly. Not merely mountains, but entire halves of worlds disrupted and fell, in such gargantuan paroxysms as the eye of man had never elsewhere beheld. And every motion generated heat. The kinetic energy of translation of two worlds became heat. Heat added to heat, piling up ragingly, frantically, unable to escape. The masses, still falling upon and through and past themselves and each other, melted, boiled, vaporized incandescently. The entire mass, the mass of three fused worlds, began to equilibrate, growing hotter and hotter as more and more of its terrific motion was converted into pure heat. Hotter, hotter, hotter! And as the grand fleet of the Galactic Patrol blasted through intergalactic space toward the first galaxy and home, there glowed behind it a new, small, comparatively cool, and probably short-lived companion to an old and long-established star. Chapter 25. Attached. The uproar of the landing was over. The celebration of victory had not yet begun. Haynes had, peculiarly enough, set a definite time for a conference with Kinnison, and the two of them were in the Admiral's private office, splitting a bottle of Phelan and discussing, apparently, nothing at all. "Narcotics has been yelling for you," Haynes finally got around to business. "But they don't need you to help them clean up the Zwilnik mess. They just want to work with you. So I told Ellington, as diplomatically as possible, to take a swan dive off an asteroid. Hicks wants you too, and Spencer and Frelinghuysen and thousands of others. See that basket full of junk? All requests for you to be submitted to you for your consideration. I submit them thus into the circular file. You see, there's something really important."
"Nix, Chief, nix. Jet back a minute, please," Kinnison implored. "Unless it's something that's got to be done right away, give me a break, can't you? I've got a couple of things to do, stuff to attend to. Maybe a little flit somewhere, too. I don't know yet."
"More important than patrol business?" Haynes asked dryly.
"Until it's cleaned up, yes." Kinnison's face burned scarlet, and his eyes revealed the mental effort necessary to make that statement. "The most important thing in the universe," he finished, quietly but doggedly.
"Well, of course, I can't give you orders." Haynes' frown was instinct with disappointment.
"Don't, Chief. That hurts. I'll be back, honest, as soon as I possibly can, and I'll do anything you want me to."
"That's enough, son." Haynes stood up and grasped Kinnison's hands hard in both his own. "I know. Forgive me for taking you for this little ride, but you and Max suffer so. You're so young, so intense, so insistent upon carrying the entire cosmos on your shoulders. I couldn't help it. You won't have to do much of a flit." He glanced at his chronometer. "You'll find all your unfinished business in room 7295, Base Hospital."
"Huh? You know, then?"
"Who doesn't? There may be a few members of some backward race somewhere who don't know all about you and your red-headed sector riot, but I don't know." He was addressing empty air. Kinnison shot out of the building, and exerting his Grey Lensman's authority, he did a thing which he had always longed boyishly to do, but which he had never before really considered doing. He whistled, shrill and piercingly, and waved a lensed arm. Even while he was directing a lensed thought at the driver of the fast ground car always in readiness at in front of Haines' office. "Base hospital, full emergency blast," he ordered, and the Jehu obeyed. That chauffeur loved emergency stuff, and the long, low, wide racer took off with a deafening roar of unmuffled exhaust and a scream of tortured burning rubber. Two projectors flamed, sending out for miles ahead of the bellowing roadster twin beams of a redness so thick as to be felt, not merely seen. Simultaneously, the mighty four-throated siren began its ululating, raucously overpowering yell, demanding and obtaining right-of-way over any and all traffic, particularly over police, fire, and other ordinary emergency apparatus, which might think it had some rights upon the street. "Thanks, Jack. You needn't wait." At the hospital's door, Kinnison rendered tribute to fast service and strode along a corridor. An express elevator whisked him up to the 72nd floor, and there his haste departed completely. This was nurse's quarters, he realized suddenly. He had no more business there than... Well, yes, he did, too. He found room 7295 and rapped upon its door. Boldly, he intended... But the resultant sound was surprisingly small. "Come in," called a clear contralto. Then, after a moment, "Come in," more sharply. But the lensman did not, could not, obey the summons. She might be, damn it all, he didn't have any business on this floor. Why hadn't he called her up or sent her a thought or something? Why didn't he think at her now? The door opened, revealing the mildly annoyed sector chief. At what she saw... Her hands flew to her throat, and her eyes widened in starkly unbelieving rapture. "Kim!" she shrieked in ecstasy. "Chris! My Chris!" Kinnison whispered unsteadily, and for minutes those two uniformed minions of the Galactic Patrol stood motionless upon the room's threshold, strong young arms straining, nurse's crisp and spotless white crushed unregarded against lensman's pliant gray. "Oh, I've missed you so terribly, my darling," she crooned. Her voice, always sweetly rich, was pure music. "You don't know the half of it. This can't be real. Nothing can feel this good." "You did come back to me. You really did," she lilted. "I didn't dare hope you could come so soon." "I had to," Kinnison drew a deep breath. "I simply couldn't stand it. It'll be tough, maybe, but you were right. Half a loaf is better than no bread." "Of course it is." She released herself partially after the first transports of their first embrace and eyed him shrewdly. "Tell me, Kim, did Lacey have a hand in this surprise?" "Uh-uh," he denied. "I haven't seen him for ages, but check back. Haines told me... Say, what'll you bet those two old hardheads haven't been giving us the works?" "Who are old hardheads?" Haines, in person, demanded. So deeply immersed had Kinnison been in his rapturous delirium that even his sense of perception was in abeyance. And there, not 2 yards from the entranced couple, stood the two old lensmen under discussion. The culprits sprang apart, flushing guiltily, but Haines went on imperturbably, quite as though nothing out of the ordinary had been either said or done. "We gave you 15 minutes and came up to be sure to catch you before you flitted off to the celebration or somewhere. We have matters to discuss."
"QX, come in, all of you."
As she spoke, the nurse stood aside in invitation.
"You know, don't you, that it's exceedingly much contra regs for nurses to entertain visitors of the opposite sex in their rooms. 50 demerits per offense. Most girls never get a chance at even one gray lensman. Here I've got 3.
She giggled infectiously. "Wouldn't it be one for the book for me to get 150 black spots for this? And to have Surgeon Marshal Lacey, Port Admiral Haines, and unattached lensman Kimball Kinnison all heaved into the clink to boot. Boy, oh boy, ain't we got fun."
"Lacey's too old, and I'm too moral to be affected by the wiles even of the likes of you, my dear," Haines explained equably, as he seated himself upon the davenport, the most comfortable thing in the room.
"Old? Moral? Tommy rot!"
Lacey glared, and "I'll see you later" look at the Admiral, then turned to the nurse.
"Don't worry about that, McDougal. No penalties accrue. Regulations apply only to nurses in the service."
"And what..."
She started to blaze. but checked herself, and her tone changed instantly. "Go on. You interest me strangely, sir. I'm just going to love this." Her eyes sparkled. Her voice was vibrant with unconcealed eagerness.
"Told you she was quick on the uptake," Lacey gloated. "Didn't fox her for a second."
"But say, listen, what's this all about anyway?" Kinnison demanded.
"Never mind, you'll learn soon enough," from Lacey, and...
"Kinnison, you are very urgently invited to attend a meeting of the Galactic Council tomorrow afternoon,"
from Haynes.
"Huh?
What's up now?" Kinnison protested. His arm tightened about the girl's supple waist, and she snuggled closer, a trace of foreboding beginning to dim the eagerness in her eyes.
"Promotion. We want to make you something. Galactic coordinator, director, something like that. The job hasn't been named yet. In plain language, the big shot of the second galaxy, formerly known as Lundmark's Nebula."
"But listen, Chief, I couldn't handle such a job as that. I simply haven't got the jets."
"You always yelp about a dynage deficiency whenever a new job is mentioned, but you deliver the goods. Who else could we wish it on to?"
"Warsel," Kinnison declared with hesitation.
"He's balloon juice," snorted the older man.
"Well then, he stopped. Clarissa opened her mouth, then shut it, ridiculously, without having uttered a word.
"Go ahead, McDougal, you're an interested party, you know."
"No," she shook her spectacular head. "I'm not saying a word, nor thinking a thought to sway his decision one way or the other. Besides, he'd have to flit around then as much as now."
"Some travel involved, of course," Haynes admitted. "All over that galaxy, some in this one, and back and forth between the two. However, the Dauntless, or something newer, bigger and faster, will be his private yacht, and I don't see why it is either necessary or desirable that his splits be solo."
"Say, I never thought of that," Kinnison blurted, and as thoughts began to race through his mind of what he could do with Chris beside him all the time, to straighten out the mess in the second galaxy... "Oh, Kim," Clarissa squealed in ecstasy, squeezing his arm even tighter against her side.
"Hooked," Lacey chortled in triumph.
"But I'd have to retire." That thought was the only thorn in Kinnison's whole wreath of roses. "I wouldn't like that."
"Certainly you wouldn't," Haynes agreed. "But remember that all such assignments are conditional, subject to approval, and with a very definite cancellation agreement in case of what the Lensman regards as an emergency. If a Grey Lensman had to give up his right to serve the patrol in any way he considered himself most able, they'd have to shoot us all before they could make executives out of us. And finally, I don't see how the job we're talking about can be figured as any sort of a retirement." "You'll be as active as you are now, yes. More so, unless I miss my guess."
"QX. I'll be there. I'll try it," Kinnison promised.
"Now for some more news," Lacey announced. "Haynes didn't tell you, but he has been made president of the Galactic Council. You are his first appointment. I hate to say anything good about the old scoundrel, but he has got one outstanding ability. He doesn't know much or do much himself, but he certainly can pick the men who have to do the work for him."
"There is something vastly more important than that," Haynes steered the acclaim away from himself.
"Just a minute," Kinnison interposed. "I haven't got this all straight yet. What was that crack about active nurses a while ago?" "Why, Dr. Lacey was just intimating that I had resigned, Goose," Clarissa chuckled. "I didn't know a thing about it myself, but I imagine it must have been just before this conference started. Am I right, Doctor?" she asked innocently.
"Or tomorrow, or even yesterday. Any convenient time will do," Lacey blandly assented. "You see, young man, McDougal has been a mighty busy girl, and wedding preparations take time, too. Therefore, we have very reluctantly accepted her resignation."
"Especially preparations take time when it's going to be such a wedding as the patrol is going to throw," Haynes commented. "That was what I was starting to talk about when I was so rudely interrupted."
"Nix, not in 7,000 years, Kinnison exploded. "Cancel that right now. I won't stand for it. I'll..."
"Cancel nothing. Baffle your jets, Kim," the Admiral said firmly. "Bridegrooms are to be seen, just barely visible, but that's all. No voice. Weddings are where the girls really strut their stuff. How about it, you gorgeous young menace to civilization?"
"I'll say so," she exclaimed in high animation.
I just love it, Admiral. She broke off, aghast. Her face fell. No, I'll take that back. Kim's right. Thanks a million, just the same, but...
But nothing, Haynes broke in. I know what's the matter. Don't try to fox an old campaigner. And don't be silly. I said the patrol was throwing this wedding. All you have to do is participate in the action. Got any money, Kinnison? On you, I mean?
No, in surprise. What would I be doing with money?
Here's 10,000 credits, patrol funds. Take it and...
He will not, the nurse stormed.
No, you can't, Admiral, really.
Why, a bride has got to buy her own clothes.
She's right, Haynes, Lacey announced.
The Admiral stared at him in wrathful astonishment, and even Clarissa seemed disappointed at her easy victory.
But listen to this. As Surgeon Marshal, etc., in recognition of the unselfish services, etc., unflinching bravery under fire, etc., performances beyond and above requirements, all reasonable expectations, etc., etc., Sector Chief Nurse Clarissa May McDougall, upon the occasion of her separation from the service, is hereby granted a bonus of 10,000 credits that goes on the record as of hour 12 today. Now, you red-headed young spitfire, if you refuse to accept that bonus, I'll cancel your resignation and put you back to work. What do you say?
I say thanks, Dr. Lacey. Thanks a million, both of you. You're two of the most wonderful men that ever lived, and I just love you. The happy girl kissed them both, then turned to Kinnison. Let's go and hike about 10 miles, shall we, Kim? I've got to do something or I'll explode.
And the tall lensman, no longer unattached, and the radiant nurse swung down the hall, side by side, in step, heads up, laughing. A beginning, symbolical indeed, of the life they were to live together. This concludes Grey Lensman by Edward E. Smith, Ph.D. This novel is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. Any resemblance to actual events, locales, or persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental. From the studios of Books in Motion in Spokane, Washington, this is Reed McCollum. Thanks for listening.